As written by Fred Provenza, foodscapes with complex mixtures of grasses, forbs, shrubs, and trees are nutrition centers and pharmacies with vast arrays of phytochemicals. Behavior ecology is his avenue of expertise, and he's with us today. Dee Dee Pursehouse, whose book, The Ecology of Care, shares only a piece of her commitment to building healthy communities both below and above ground. And Safianu Moro knows all about giving palm oil production back its reputation as a beautiful and very useful plant as he heads up Serendi Palm in Ghana. I'm Robin Clare with Cultivated Audio. Now let's dig in. Fred, let's start with the premise that we are a community with all of nature, and nature is not a commodity. That's a jumping off point for regenerative ag, isn't it?
Yes, it certainly is. And trying to recognize and come to appreciate again that we are members of nature's communities, and that what we do to them, ultimately we end up doing to ourselves, I think is really important.
And it's very worthwhile to bring up that, as you write, most soils aren't deficient in nutrients, just deficient in good caretakers and farming, ranching practices. Could you address this a bit?
Yes. Let me preface by saying hindsight is always 20/20, huh? And so
yes.
We do seem like there's always unanticipated and unintended consequences. We've really declared war on plant communities and soils with herbicides, pesticides, tillage, all the kind of practices that were really ushered in during the Green Revolution. And you read back to the ideals and what people were thinking and wanting to do, and it was great, really. But downstream now we see all these unintended consequences that have really wreaked havoc on plants, plant diversity. I like to say, too, that plants turn dirt into soil, and diverse mixtures of plants turn soil into homes, grocery stores, and pharmacies for creatures below ground and above ground. So it's the linkages, and I think amongst the plants, the life that's below and above ground, that are really the critical thing. And when you look at what's happened with industrial ag, we've really broken all of those linkages, and it's had some really negative downstream effects on life and the nutrient-deficient states that plants experience.
Yes, and I believe you called it litter, to litter the ground with even leaves or other compostables, but plant roots are able to do so much more, and that's why cover cropping is so important. And maybe you could go into some of the reasons why.
Yeah, absolutely the case. And I think some of the more interesting research that soil scientists are doing nowadays is to recognize that litter is just one component of fixing carbon and helping to nurture soils. Plants, through the exudates that they release, like soluble carbohydrates, energy sources, that is to say, and amino acids and so forth, they nurture bacteria in the soil. And when plants are releasing lots of these nutrients, bacterial populations boom. They really grow and develop in big ways. And what's super interesting then is it's the dead carcasses of these microbial populations that end up being really sources of carbon in the soil. So at least half of the carbon that can get fixed in soils is dead bodies of microbes, which is pretty amazing. Historically, we've thought that litter is a primary component of soils, and it certainly is. But to realize the huge roles that microbial populations are playing in that as well is really interesting insight.
Yes, and I was going to cover this a little later, but since you brought up the microbiome, it's certainly critical, and yet it's become such a fad concept right now, and there's kind of a danger in that. And I'm wondering if you see that as well, or if a point comes to you right now that you'd like to address, because I think when something becomes a fad, then it becomes the thing, and the relationship gets lost, its relationship to everything.
Amen. I'm so happy, Rob, actually, that you brought that point up, because I think these things all the time. Let me step back in time just 50 years, I guess.
Sure.
When I was a young researcher taking classes in ruminant nutrition, the whole focus, the entire focus, is on the microbiome. We're into this 50, 60, 70 years ago, and everything that they wrote about and talked about, it seemed to me, had to do with the rumen and its microbes, It's like, well, there's a whole other creature that's attached to this rumen and its microbes. And so throughout my career, when we were studying all these behaviors of animals, I never made a big point of the rumen and its microbes for the reason that you pointed out. You know, I think when we get on to a new topic, it's interesting, it's fascinating to us, and rightly so with microbiome kind of things. But then we forget that that's one part of complex, interactive, dynamic system. That's why I like to start out and say plants turn dirt into soil and diverse mixtures of plants, because it tries to make that idea that it's a system, and there's so many linkages from the plants to the soil to the organisms below and above ground and so forth and so on. We're not saying that it's not important, but just trying to step back and put that into a bit of a broader perspective. I see so many parallels between what people are talking about below ground nowadays and life below ground, and what we studied with life above ground and the relationships that get formed. For instance, the notion of plant diversity and what I like to talk about quite a lot, phytochemical diversity. That is to say, plants produce not only energy, protein, minerals, and so forth, but they produce this prodigious amount of these so-called secondary compounds that come under these broad classes like phenolics, terpenes, alkaloids, and tens of thousands of these compounds. But the key is that years ago, ecologists were understanding that that diversity really enables animals above ground to meet their needs, not only for nutrients, but for health as we've gone along. One young ecologist sent me a note saying, we were really surprised by this finding. And I said, I wasn't surprised at all. And it was the idea that when you get diverse mixtures of plants and you have diverse secondary chemistries, that is benefiting microbial populations below ground. And it's like, well, that's the same thing that happens above ground. And so I'm tickled that you raised that, because most people don't do that. The focus is so much on soil and soil microbiome. The systems can get forgotten about.
Yes, and of course, the same thing has happened in medicine. Everyone becomes a specialist, and then the whole gets lost in the pieces. With your background, Fred, and work literally in the field and in lab research, your knowledge of how animals have such an innate wisdom to know what to eat and when is fitting right in here, because when you see animals out in pastures or out in nature, there are basic plants they eat. But just as you mentioned, these other plants might be considered secondary, and yet their roles are so primary. I'm wondering, have you witnessed what happens to a herd that originally was not pasture-raised, and then they were moved to fully cover-cropped pastures, and what might happen to and for them in that shift?
Two thoughts come to mind. I'll start first with yours, and then I'd like to come back to this other one. You know, I think what people are starting to appreciate, livestock producers, is that when they move away from monoculture pastures to more diverse mixtures of plant pastures, morbidity and mortality go down. The health of animals improves. What happens in terms of their nutrition, physiology, immune responses, and so forth. So health improves, and the amount of supplemental kind of fossil fuel intensive supplements that a person needs to give, whether that would be mineral supplements, protein or energy supplements, or antibiotics and anthelmintics to get rid of bacterial infections or internal parasites. Animals are able to do all of those things, that wisdom of the body that you mentioned. But if they don't have suitable alternatives or an array of alternatives, we put them in a box, and then we have to make up for that with inputs that we give. There's a second part to this that I find really interesting, and it's on my mind because a livestock producer sent me a note 2 days ago, and I'll preface by saying I've had similar notes from many, many livestock producers, but it's always the same, and it's that You know, when our livestock have a choice between GMO and non-GMO crop or deer, they very, very strongly prefer the non-GMO to the GMO. Are our animals trying to tell us something? They're so in tune, I think, with their bodies. That's what struck me over the years. Let's bring mother into the story here, too.
Oh, yes.
Transgenerational linkages to landscapes become so critical. You know, they start to learn in the womb. Flavors and amniotic fluid, the fetal taste system's fully functional during the last trimester of gestation. So foods that mom's eating, the young animal's already starting to learn about that. Flavors in her milk, and then we can bring in this whole notion of epigenetics, that genes are being switched on. That's changing the development of organ systems, the function of those organs, and so it's a whole response. And then one could say, well, that same thing's happening with microbes in the soil, with earthworms, with mountain bluebirds, becoming locally adapted to a landscape and learning the ropes and multiple factors involved in that.
Yes, absolutely. And one of the ingredients that I know you bring up, the importance of tannins. And I'm wondering if you would share that and also maybe what plants farmers, it would behoove them to plant in order to help round out the diets of these ruminants.
You know, I'll preface my remarks by saying I try to avoid single compound emphasis, whether it's human nutrition or animal nutrition or whatever. But if we step back and talk about tannins in a more general way as kind of a broad class of compounds, they do several things. In ruminant nutrition, there's a term referred to as bypass protein. And when they're ruminant nutritionists are feeding really high-quality protein and they don't want microbes in the rumen to break that protein down. They want it to be absorbed by the animal itself. They'll protect it. They have different ways to protect it so the microbes can't break it down, but when it gets to the more acidic pH lower in the GI tract, the compounds dissociate. Well, tannins do that very same thing. They bind the proteins and they protect them from microbial decomposition. And so bottom line is that the nutrition of ruminants can be enhanced by having some tannin in the diet. Tannins also have anti-parasitic effects, so they can reduce loads of internal parasites as well. Then we can go to some of the issues related to climate change and greenhouse gas emissions, and tannins can help to reduce methane emissions in ruminants. And so, you know, when I first was getting involved in this, and so much research was being done by chemical ecologists, and tannins were viewed, these secondary compounds were viewed in a negative light. We all saw them as deterrents. They deter animals from eating plants, and certainly they do that. But what we weren't recognizing so much is in small doses, these things can have tremendous health benefits, and tannins really are one example of that.
Yes, and it's interesting, too. I know there have been some anthropological studies about humans when they are given the opportunity to eat intuitively.
The issue with humans nowadays, all those factors that we were talking about that really enable the nutritional wisdom of the body have basically been hijacked. If we think of it as three legs to a stool, the availability of alternatives, flavor feedback relationships, and then transgenerational linkages, they've all broken down in the last century. As the flavors of wholesome foods have become blander during the last half century, these ultra-processed foods have become basically irresistible. And so we've disincentivized real foods because they don't taste good anymore. And the food industry has really figured out how to enhance flavors and then follow that with a blast of energy in the form of refined carbs. Then there's this whole idea, well, why have our foods become really bland? That's meat as well as produce and fruits and so forth. And there's really three things, I think, that have contributed. The varieties we've selected for, we've really selected for yield as opposed to phytochemical and biochemical richness of products, which would give that wonderful flavor.
Of course.
And the conditions we grow crops under, you know, when you irrigate and fertilize plants, you can enhance growth, again, at the expense of phytochemical richness. So that's kind of quick and dirty, but it's really led us on this path where we've disincentivized really wholesome foods that are good for our body and incentivize the ultra-processed kinds of foods that we know aren't helpful for us.
Right. So, Fred, what do you see at the top of the list for increasing nutritive quality and digestibility of forages for animals?
You know, when it comes to forages for animals, we went down a similar path, too. You know, if you think that in an agronomic sense that, you know, what you want to do is get a forage out there that's really high in energy and high in protein, and you just put it in a monoculture and really not a feedlot kind of approach, but kind of that, just try to maximize gains, then it moves us away from this whole notion of plant diversity and phytochemical richness and the benefits that that has not only for the health of the animals, but then ultimately for our health as well. As you move away from a monoculture or a feedlot ration, the phytochemical and biochemical richness of meat and dairy products is enhanced. So it's scaling up then as you go from plant diversity to soil health to livestock and other wildlife creature health to human health. You have the linkages there. Just to wind back quickly, what we did as we moved toward monoculture, we selected against secondary compounds because they set a limit on intake. That's what's clear, is they limit how much any individual can eat of a particular plant. Well, if you have a diverse array of plants, that's no problem. Animals are really good eating a little bit of this, a little bit of that. But if you're going to go toward monoculture, then you've got to select against those. And when you look at the modern varieties of pasture plants that we grow, and we've done it with our crops as well, they're really low in those so-called secondary compounds compared to the ancestral varieties.
So you're not saying, well, we should have more clover or more alfalfa in our cover crops. We just need the variety going and growing. And then once that starts, all of those effects will multiply within itself, I guess, yeah?
You know, that's absolutely the case. It's just win-win-win kind of situations for the health of landscapes and all of the wildlife species that live on those landscapes. And then that scales up to human health as well.
Explain the facts around your statement that an omnivorous diet rich in whole plants and animal foods has the greatest potential to feed human populations globally.
That's a really good question. Let's just dive in a little bit on that and see how far we get. You know, one of the things that strikes me, how we go to extremes of one way or the other. I have friends that live only on plants. I have friends that live only on meat and so forth. I think if you look at the human species, no matter where we occur on the globe, we are omnivorous. Certainly one could argue that as you go in northern latitudes, there's more meat, but every opportunity people get seasonally, they incorporate plant materials into their diet. As you go toward the tropics, where you become more plant dominated in the diet, people still eat meat. And it's simply that a combination of plant and animal foods can best help us to meet our needs. So this idea of omnivory, I think, is very important in terms of balance and health. And certainly some people can live at the extremes, but I think for most humans, it's rich combinations of different foods, herbs and spices and meats and vegetables and fruits and so forth, are etiologic in health. That's really important for our health.
And so the argument that grazing animals take up so much land and all of that, what's your one statement you want to say about that?
In all my years academically and then the years on the ranch, ruminant animals, goats, sheep, and cattle, in the work that we and many other people did, were used to enhance the biodiversity and the health of landscapes. I've done a lot of work with people in France. We refer to shepherds in France as ecological doctors because they're building the health of ecosystems. So certainly grazing can degrade landscapes. Range science came out of that, the abuse of land that took place in the late 1800s, early 1900s. Too many animals overgrazed landscapes. Flip side of that is that animals can be used to build health into ecosystems. When I left the ranch and went to graduate school at Utah State University, I went there for one reason. The program there was focused on using domestic animals to enhance habitat for wildlife species, and I thought, I want to be involved in that. And then when you get into different combinations of plant species and what's possible, then you can start to get into nuance of greenhouse gas emissions. And it becomes, well, you know, it depends on how landscapes are grazed, what animals have access to. If you're involved in shepherding, you know, some of the people that are in regen ag now are really getting into animals and moving animals on a regular basis, maybe once a day, maybe even a couple times. Well, a shepherd, what he's doing is throughout the day, just setting up meal courses, appetizers, main courses, booster stages, dessert stages, and all those are meant to enhance the health of everything in the landscape, including the livestock. And then you start to think about, well, what's that do for greenhouse gas emissions? And there are ways that that can be tamped down as well, that we alluded to with tannin-containing plants, and in ways that people haven't even started to look at yet.
Yes. So back in the day when the shepherds were naturally doing their thing, it was innate.
Absolutely on target with that, Robin. My colleague and friends and I wrote a paper titled Where Art and Science Meet. And what we were doing was simply saying that the shepherds are out there and they're engaged with their environment and with the animals in their environment. And they're learning from the animals, and the animals are learning from them. It's a two-way street. Their knowledge of behavior is phenomenal. They're learning from the animals. They're experimenting all the time, and they're saying, well, what are the animals telling me? And that's what we did research-wise. That was our program. We were always asking the animals questions and then learning from what they were telling them. If you have an appetizer of birdsfoot creek oil, which contains tannins, and then you move sheep or cattle on to endophyte infected tall fescue, which by all rights is a kind of a toxic plant, very high in alkaloids, those tannins bind up the alkaloids, which are nitrogen-based, so you have that tannin protein binding going on, and that's what's enabling it. But the key observations, that's where the shepherds have been, and that's to appreciate the knowledge of people who are out there day in, day out. And you can think that their knowledge comes to their brains through their hands, in a sense, not through working with the environment.
Beautifully said. And Fred, we'll never know which came first, of course, but I'm glad to know that you are equally a scientist and philosopher. And there's a wonderful quote from you that says, the ability to perceive the world differently is far more important than any scientific knowledge we appear to gain about the working of soils, plants, animals, people, and the environment we inhabit. That's a nutshell, if there ever was one.
There's just something in us, I think, that resonates with that. And I always think of that quote of Aldo Leopold, that there's two spiritual dangers in not owning a farm. One is the danger of thinking that food comes from the grocer, the other that heat comes from the furnace. He says, to avoid the first danger, one should plant a garden, preferably where there's no grocer to confuse the issue. To avoid the second, lay a good split of oak on the andirons and let it warm your shin as a February blizzard tosses the trees outdoors. Linking us back with our mother, basically, we're from the earth.
Didi, I've heard you say since a hurricane literally blew through your place and fed the river to take out roads, you took your attention away from peak oil to what happens when water meets soil.
Yes, and that was really the beginning of my understanding of the fact that climate change isn't just about things getting warmer, that it really, really has to do with water in the system. And that understanding then in turn led me to realizing that water plays its own role in our changing climate. So it's actually both directions, that climate is influencing water and that water is influencing climate. And that connection of soil and water actually is the centerpiece of both our climate resilience and potentially of climate mitigation as well.
Yes. As you advocate, the soil sponge might just be the perfect leverage point for effective community investment. And I'm wondering if you would start by describing what the soil sponge is, how it works, etc.
Yeah, so this soil sponge is language that we've been developing for the structure and function of healthy soil. And that's what happens to the sand, silt, and clay particles when they're in contact with life. When plant roots are in contact with sand, silt, and clay, they feed underground life that creates biofilms and glues that helps to glue those little separate particles together into aggregates. And then the threads of life, plant root hairs and fungal hyphae, help to tie those aggregates into the little bundles. And all of that starts creating space underground. And then, of course, life moves through there, everything from the roots to worms to gophers and snakes, et cetera, and creates all different size tunnels in between these different size pores. And that space underground, it's kind of interesting. It's like the nothingness is what makes it something. So having space underground means that water and air can flow underground and that more life can live underground and can create more structure underground. Why is that important? That's important because the example I often use is think about a plate of flour and a plate of bread. Bread is those loose particles of flour that have been turned into a structure by life, right? The yeast, in this case, in the bread. If you take a plate of flour and you blow on it, a big wind comes along. If you think of that as a degraded landscape that's just reverted back to the mineral particles, it blows away. If you rain on that plate of flour, the particles wash away. And anyone who's done any baking knows that when you have these loose separate particles and you pour water on it, the water runs off, it erodes, creates like mudslides on a landscape scale, but it doesn't get down below the surface. So like where the plant roots are, even with a heavy rain, there's nothing getting through. Whereas if you were to rain on this plate of bread, because of two things, the porosity, but also the structural integrity of it, means that the rain can get in. So there's this incredible thing with a soil sponge or with bread, where you have both water acceptance and water resistance within one system. So you have pores and you have water resistant biofilms and glues and threads that are holding it all together. So when you have that soil sponge, you can hold 9, 10, 20 times as much water in the land, holding it there for plant growth, protecting the system from flooding, providing resilience against drought, holding the soil in place so you don't have water erosion or wind erosion, which makes for much, much, much cleaner rivers and lakes and oceans and much cleaner air. But you also have the capacity to grow green plants for much, much longer of a season and more abundance because you have water in the system. And when plants are growing, they are cooling the air around them. When they're photosynthesizing, they're also transpiring water, just like us, the way we sweat. And that not only cools the plant, but it also cools the air around the plant. NASA just actually put out something referring to a paper that was published recently, basically saying that plants are our lonely only climate solution, that they're starting to see that green plant growth is the thing that we need now that can actually change the climate now. Whereas the other piece that's happening as plants are growing and creating this soil sponge underground is that all that life underground is carbon, and all of the life of the plants and all of the life that the plants are feeding, including us, that's all carbon that's not circulating in this random, disorganized fashion in the atmosphere. It's carbon that's in the wondrous forms of life for however long that life lives, and also gradually being stored in non-living forms underground. So we have deep, rich stores of soil carbon that are also helping to balance out and draw down the carbon that would be in the atmosphere, getting both cooling from the water and long-term potential climate mitigation from soil carbon in one system.
Yes. And as you write, the two primary actions of soil biology are structure and passageways, which you were just discussing the structure. And the passageways really develop the inner workings for growth and for life underground.
Yeah. And it's not just life underground, though, because also, of course, if you have more space underground, the roots can reach down and go all different places that they wouldn't be able to go.
Right.
So you have healthier plants above ground, and then you have everything above ground that's not in the oceans that's eating that life. And there's a whole other piece here in terms of health and resilience and healthy communities and regenerating healthy life on the planet, which is that all of that life underground suddenly has access to much more mineral surface area. And also there's a lot more life and enzymes and intelligence seeking out the nutrients and communicating with the plants of what they need right now against the viral diseases that are affecting the plants, the fungal diseases affecting the plants, the insects that are going after the plants. And so when the plants have access to this communication system of the life underground and also much more mineral surface area underground through those microbial symbionts, the symbiotic relationships underground, then you have plants that have all of the chemicals and nutrients and micronutrients that they need to fend off disease. And everything that eats from a system that has these incredibly flavorful, aromatic, almost medicinal foods.
Yes.
We're all getting those benefits. A lot of the immune issues we're seeing is because plants are being grown in systems that are just basically sand, silt, and clay that they're being propped up in and then sprayed with artificial nutrients or artificial protection against these issues, as opposed to getting the nutrition they need to actually be healthy.
Right.
And we're in the same position. We're being propped up by vitamins and medicines and antibiotics.
True.
You know, and insect repellents and whatever, and vaccines. Our systems aren't getting the nutrients that they need to do that naturally.
Right.
So we're seeing effects of things being grown in bed soils rather than in the soil sponge.
Yes, and thankfully, due to a lot of folks like yourself, we're also seeing the results of what happens when we come back to all of that. And one more thing about the soil sponge I'd like to have you touch upon is how the natural effect of filtering the water is a direct result of healthy soil and healthy soil sponge. And you talk about the physically and biologically filtered water. How do you see them as two separate things?
So if you think of this huge spongy layer on the earth, when we think about spring water, that's water that's gone through this huge, basically carbon filter of the ground. So it's literally capturing particles of things that shouldn't be going into the water, and it's coming out clean. But there's another aspect that's happening, which is that the biology in an active living soil eats some of those pollutants and metabolizes them in such a way that they're broken back down into less harmful molecules. Some of it is just capturing particulate matter, and some of it is actually taking apart long chains, like someone's poured antifreeze or gasoline or there's an oil spill, etc., taking that apart and turning it into something that's less toxic.
It is such an intelligent system, as you used that word earlier. And would you share, Dee Dee, a first step to creating a healthy soil sponge? And would it differ for someone that has 1,000+ acres or someone who's a backyard gardener?
The principles are actually the same. And I always tell people that if you can't remember these principles, just look out your window or look at a picture of a natural landscape and you'll be reminded of these principles. One principle is that the soil is generally not disturbed on a large scale. So minimizing or eliminating rototilling, tillage, plowing, et cetera, as much as you can. Now, sometimes it's needed to break new ground, but even there, people are coming up with great ways to not have to disturb the soil. Because every time you disturb the soil, it's like taking that bread or that sponge and putting it in a blender. It may seem like it's fluffing it up, but ultimately you're breaking the structure.
Yes.
So that's one. Another thing is that nature never really grows things in a monoculture. So the diversity, we're learning more literally every day about what people are calling quorum sensing, which is the intelligence of a diverse community. And human language might call it collective genius. And kind of how we see people solving these like almost unsolvable problems when everybody starts working on it together on the internet. And that's happening through all this signaling between different species, between different plant families, and more diversity is feeding more microbial diversity, more insect diversity, more pollinators and different animals, et cetera. So that's a key piece. Another is that unless the system has been interfered with artificially, which it's hard to find places on the planet that haven't had human disturbance in a negative way. But even as they grow back, you'll see that nature does not like to have bare soil. And even what we call weeds or invasives, you could call them the first responders. Plants will try to find a way to photosynthesize even in very poor soil. So if you're driving along the highway and there's a crack in the pavement, you know, there will be a plant that's finding its way up.
Yes.
Because plants are always trying to recreate that soil sponge. So making sure that you have either perennial plants or cover crops, that you don't leave soil bare, that's not just between crops, but also that you don't have bare soil between the rows if you can manage it.
Right.
So people are doing like diverse pollinator strips or low perennial ground covers between the rows, which means that you're always photosynthesizing and pumping more sugars down to the soil food web underground. And then it's not just living plants. You also need some dead and decaying plants because that feeds a different part of the soil food web, just like we need different kinds of fibers and things in our diet. So having plants growing that create their own mulch or their own litter layer is key. And then congruent with that is composting back and adding back in what was taken off. Because if you're taking plants off, you need to be offering something back.
Yes, yes.
And I strongly recommend there are two composting methods of people who are really thinking about how to compost in a way that is in line with how nature does it.
Yes.
And that is Dr. Elaine Ingham's Soil Food Web School and Dr. David Johnson's bioreactor. Those are two increasingly trusted systems. Compost isn't soil. So compost is more of like a biostimulant. So it doesn't necessarily need to be applied in great quantity. It's right. Really about quality.
Absolutely. Yes. Yes.
And the last thing that nature does that we tend to ignore when we're trying to grow food is that nature never farms without animals. And animals means everything from microbes underground and worms, etc., to birds and insects, including some plant, what we would call pests. Like those are grazing animals, the insects that eat the leaves and leaf droppings, etc. And then all the way up to actual grazing animals, whether they're wild or domestic. Animals of all sizes and shapes have some role to play. And if we can invite them all to the table, they will find ways to regulate populations. It's when we try to intervene too much that the dysregulation happens. So the more pesticides that are used, the more so-called pest insects will be on a farm. Because if you kill off everybody, you kill off the predator insects that eat the vegetarian insects, and you kill off the vegetarian insects, who has food first when they come back to the farm? The vegetarians have food first because there's all the plants. So you end up with increasing numbers of these vegetarian insects who want the leaves, but you've killed off the omnivorous or the carnivorous insects who would eat them. And then you just end up with a system with more and more and more plant eating insects in it. And that's been shown really clearly in the work of John Lundgren.
Right. That's a brilliant point that not many are bringing up. And Dee Dee, could you share a success story that you've been part of or privy to? I know you have been involved, or perhaps you started the Rehydrate California initiative. And this could be another whole interview, but maybe you can just give us a brief explanation of what you got to see in a short amount of time.
The Rehydrate California initiative is more of a placeholder for multi-stakeholders to think about how we might rehydrate California. It started with a series of workshops that Walter Yena and I gave throughout California. Is it possible to rehydrate California without bringing water in from other places? One aspect is that there's water vapor available in the atmosphere that is no longer condensing onto plants because we don't have enough plants there. There's too much evaporation happening. And then when it rains, are we actually capturing the water? And then Michael Kravchuk and Occidental Arts and Ecology Center's work around beavers and or human interventions that help mimic beaver activity of slowing down water as it's moving. But I like to talk about if you have plants across the whole landscape, you are creating billions of micro dams. You're creating turbulent flow, slowing down water movement across the whole landscape. People who are thinking about slowing streams are like way downstream from the soil sponge. The more water picks up speed and the further it travels, it's doing more and more damage and you're losing more and more. So I like to think about how do we capture it as soon as it falls into the soil sponge. Right. So that's one initiative. The other really exciting one that's much further along in many ways is the Andhra Pradesh Community Managed Natural Farming Initiative. And that's in India. And I have been working to help train the trainers and develop materials for them in conjunction with the United Nations Farmer Field School Program. In that program, they are using regenerative agriculture in one state in India. They're getting close to 1 million farmers who have adopted it. So about 1 out of every 8 farmers in Andhra Pradesh, the southeastern state in India. What's fun there is that we have an annual soil sponge conference in Vermont, and the person who is sort of heading up this initiative in Andhra Pradesh a few years back saw a long recording from our conference and realized that it might be possible to grow crops before the rainy season if we could build enough of a soil sponge and harness enough of this atmospheric water vapor and capture the little rain that fell and wake up the soil biology. So they now have 300,000 farmers who are doing pre-monsoon dry sowing and doubling or tripling the amount of food they're producing and extending the green growing season, which is also that cooling, transpiring season.
Yes.
Which is also capturing way more carbon and storing in soils and creating healthier plants and people and air and water. So that's really fun for me that it goes back to a small conference we held that had less than 50 people attending here.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing.
But to me, the story there is that I was just focused on creating a deep learning experience here. Like when I put on a conference, we have maybe 2 speakers and we get to talk for days on end, get everybody involved in deep conversation and breakout groups, et cetera, rather than the 20-minute soundbite conference. So as a speaker, I appreciate having time to go deep. And here's Vijay Kumar in India, who's a very deep thinker. And he went for the 2.5-hour video rather than skipping around to every little TED talk.
Right. I can only imagine. I have a huge smile on my face. I can imagine what yours must be like knowing that you were able to spur all of that on and give so much inspiration. And Didi, you have written a book, The Ecology of Care, and it shifted focus, it seems, from its original vision of sustainable medicine as an acupuncturist. That's what world you were in. And I'm wondering if you would just touch upon the very tip of the sustainable medicine iceberg and give a mini synopsis of how you've seen real medicine benefit the entire system, ecological and economic system.
It's an interesting story because I started off trying to think about what rising oil prices or lack of oil might, how that might impact the healthcare system. And then several years into working on writing about that, that flood happened, and I realized that soil was really central to the whole thing. And I actually gave up my one-on-one medical practice to turn my attention to soil health as public health. And that's actually changed the whole nature of the book, as you said. But what's intriguing to me is that the very first part of that book that I wrote back in 2005 or six was something that I called the Ecological Medicine Manifesto. And it was basically making the same points that I have come full circle to, which is that humans can't be healthy unless the whole ecosystem around them and the whole planet that they live on is healthy. That disconnection of our understanding of science and living systems has led to incredible fragmentation of our capacity to even be healthy or even think about health, including our relationships with each other. The subtitle of the book is now Medicine, Agriculture, Money, and the Quiet Power of Human and Microbial Communities. And, you know, with the pandemic coming, I was like, wow, there was so much in the book that I was thinking about 10, 11 years ago that is really coming to fruition here, including what is really motivating pharmaceutical development and how do we know where to put our trust and how do communities adapt in times where there are shortages of medications and how do living systems actually work to create health and what can we do as humans to participate in that without screwing things up?
Right.
You know, so
yes.
These days, my work is mostly in teaching, and that's through something called the Land and Leadership Initiative.
Yes.
And that's where I'm really working now is developing people's capacity to image, and I don't mean imagine, but I mean actually image, see living systems at work and to understand it as these flows of water, of carbon, of nutrients, of information, of and to understand how to intervene meaningfully without screwing things up. So it's a bit like my original work as an acupuncturist, seeing this system of flows in the body and where can I put a little rock in the stream that's going to change everything downstream? And the more that I've played in water and played with rocks, stood in cool, transpiring forests and meadows versus stood barefoot on pavement and hot dirt roads, the more that I have an innate sense of how living systems work, my own and the one around me, and then my actions are going to be more in line with the systems around me. A friend of mine this morning was talking about a horse who had been deeply scared by something and needed to get its breath back in alignment with its movement. Like when it was running, it wasn't breathing in time to the
right.
movement.
Wow.
And that the person who the horse lived with had to have it like run in circles for like half an hour until it got itself back settled and in alignment. That was such a beautiful image to me because I feel like that's what we're needing to do is to like feel and play with and work with the systems till it just comes naturally to us. Like, oh, no, I would never break up the soil because soil holds water. I would never have bare soil because that's not how nature does it. It doesn't work. I'm terrible at weeding because I'm always busy on some world tour somewhere. So my plot is always overgrown, but it has 10 times better soil structure than any of everybody else's who have been weeding and leaving big bare spots and tilling at the end of it.
Of course. I have a friend who was just thrown out of the community garden here in Boulder because he didn't clean his garden and basically yeah. make it barren at the end of last season. He's like, what? Oh, boy. Safianu, it's time we brought palm oil into a favorable focus. And yes, there has been too much slashing and burning going on for planting palm oil trees. But thanks to folks like you, there is a big turn in the tide happening. And I've read recently that 45% of the growers in Indonesia are smallholders. And you can share with us what it's like in Ghana. There's a big shift going on there as well, isn't there?
Yeah, so oil palm, basically it's popularly grown in the eastern, western, and central regions of Ghana. Increasingly, smallholder farmers planting new fields. Originally, there was an increasing interest in planting citrus, but over the years, for reasons of marketing, lots of farmers have cut down their citrus fields and planted them to oil palm. And most people that do oil palm in Ghana are actually smallholder farmers. There are plantations, you know, such as the Ghana Oil Palm Development Company, the Benso Oil Palm, but those are very few compared to the number of smallholder farmers we have in Ghana doing oil palm production.
Are you doing solely agroforestry with the palm oil? How is that environment going on in Ghana and the people that you work with?
Serendi Palm worked with farmers who had both oil palm and cocoa for a very long time. We worked with them for several years, and somewhere in 2016, we started diversifying. We felt there was the need to help farmers get organic or premium markets for cocoa as well as the palm. So we started looking at how to expand the cocoa projects at Serendi Palm. And along the line, we met, were introduced to Ecotop Consults in Bolivia. And ever since we had meetings with them about agroforestry, I think it's become Serendi Palm's focus for the future. So we've gone on to get several of our smallholder farmers to plant their fields to dynamic agroforestry. And Serendi Palm has also started another project where we need to plant some 300 hectares of dynamic agroforestry fields by 300 smallholder farmers. And we are currently in the second year. It looks like we are very much on course towards achieving that. And then Serendi Palm has also just lease a land for itself to go into a commercial and demo farm planted to dynamic agroforestry and used to train farmers. Most of the farmers are interested in doing it. We think it's a production system that protects the farmer, protects the crop that he's cultivating, and then also protects the land. And it's the current focus now, and we are happy all our farmers are coming along.
Yes. Now, what about the production? Obviously, if you're diversifying crops, then the farmer can make money not only from the palm oil, but whatever other fruit trees or plants that they're growing. But do you see that yields are compromised as a whole when you have small farmers that are doing diversified crops?
Yeah, not at all. Yields rather are increasing. So for instance, a farmer who is currently cultivating oil, only oil palm, might be getting 4.5 tons per acre per year. And that is a Serendi Palm farmer who is certified organic. And it's getting that because of the trainings that is received from our internal control systems team of extension officers.
Yes.
For such a farmer, if he were to move into dynamic agroforestry, he might not get the 4.5 tons per acre per year from his land. But because of the other crops that he's brought onto the land, he now gets some yields or harvests from cocoa. He gets something from citrus. He gets something from mango, avocado, bananas, cassava, ginger, turmeric, and all other crops. And if you aggregate the yields or the harvests, he gets more than 2 times what he would have had from just oil palm alone. So definitely aggregated yields go up and he gets more than twice the income that he would have had. So it's far, far better than just having a monocrop of oil palm.
Yes. And the kids sure get to eat a lot of great food too.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's lots of fruits available to the family, you know, and other people living with a farmer.
Yes. Now, is it true that 10 times less land is needed to produce palm oil than it takes for other plants to grow the similar yield of oil?
Exactly. It's very true, simply because of the extraction rate that you get from oil palm. It's really, really good. The extraction rate Serendi palm gets from its male, roughly 18%, which is really, really good. And that immediately tells you that if you want to get that from another crop that gives you roughly 9% extraction rates, then you need more land to actually cultivate, or you need twice as much the land to be able to get that amount of oil extraction rates.
Yes. And the oil is made from both the nut and the fruit. Is that correct? Are they two distinctly different types of oils, and do they have distinctly different uses?
Definitely, yes. You get the crude oil from the fresh fruit bunches from the pulp, and then inside that you have the nuts, and inside the nuts is a kernel. So you get palm kernel oil from that as well, and they have different uses. So whereas you can use palm oil in making several foods in Ghana, there are other uses for the palm kernel oil. You can use it as a substitute for coconut oil, and you can combine both also in making soaps.
As far as the processing goes and removing the pulp, is the processing that you use, knowing that your product is organic, is it different than the monocultured industrial way of producing the oil?
In terms of the processing itself?
Yes. Well, I was thinking of the mill. I didn't know if the monocultured industrial model was more of a toxic process. And I wonder if there's a co-op going on between the many small farmers that have one mill, or are they all processing on their own?
Yeah, so we have, for instance, local mills around who process with locally fabricated equipment, and normally the environment within which they process their palm oil is not, it's not so tidy, even though they end up getting some level of good palm oil depending on the fruits they use. So for instance, you would see people stepping on the expelled or the pressed fruits from screw presses with their feet, you know, in a hole, and then from there they move on to clarifying the palm oil. But when you compare that with our system, it's completely different. So Serendi Palm runs a system where you have fruits that come from the fields, you get them weighed, and then after weighing, these fruits are chopped or axed by production workers, and then it's collected to fruit cleaning unit where women clean the fruits patiently. So they take their time to clean each single fruit before they are steamed. And then after steaming, they go through pressing. And then after pressing, we move them to a collection tank and then pump to a mixer tank before it's clarified using either a decanter or clarifier. So the processes are such that whatever germs you have that come with the oil palm or the loose fruits are ultimately sterilized before you end up with your palm oil. And the equipment we use are well cleaned, regularly maintained compared to the kind of equipment other local mills in the area use.
Yes, and do the other mills, do they use high levels of heat which would destroy the good parts of the oils, or?
Unfortunately, for the bigger ones, I would say yes, but for the local mills that look more artisanal, I think the bad stuff they use would normally be burning of ties, car ties. They use that in either steaming their fruit or the clarification process. Mm. Those are the differences that they have.
What market do you have for your palm oils? You mentioned earlier that coconut and palm oil are both used in soaps, for instance. Do you ever sell bottles of palm oil for uses in the kitchen?
Yes. So most of the oil we produce actually for exports, and we export more than 75% of it to Dr. Bronner's in the US. And then we have two other customers in Germany, that's Rapunzel and then Gepa. And then apart from that, there are people who also buy bottles, gallon, 4.5 liters each from the company regularly. Some are company employees, others are guests or visitors that come to visit Serenity Farm and to see dynamic agroforestry farms.
It must taste so good when it's just fresh like that. I can only imagine.
It's really good. It tastes really good, and you can use it for local dishes, mashed plantain mixed with palm oil and just boiled eggs or fish. Or you can also use it for red, which is beans, boiled beans with palm oil, and then fried plantain also with palm oil. Tastes good.
Oh, I bet it does. My mouth is kind of watering right now.
So the palm kernel oil, we don't produce that. So we sell our nuts to third parties, and then they do the palm kernel oil. So it's the palm kernel oil that is a substitute for coconut oil, and we can use that for soaps and other cosmetics.
Ah, I see. How do local people use the other parts of the plant?
You can use the palm fronds in the fields actually to mulch the soil. So that's one good thing about it. You can also use some of them to make baskets. Use the palm fronds to make baskets. Very, very nice ones, locally handmade baskets to use at home. And then, you know, you can tap palm wine also from the oil palm when it is felled in the end. And then you can also use them to make mats for drying of cocoa. Yes, so it has several other uses. And
do people eat the fruit?
Yes, there are people who eat them fresh, except that they don't taste that good when they are fresh.
Gotcha.
But there are people who also just chew the kernels because of how they taste. That's not something most people would do.
Yeah. Is there something else about the palm oil plant itself or the industry that you'd like to share that I haven't touched upon?
Yes, I think oil palm crop, it's very unique. Unique in the sense that if you just look at the type of farmers that we work with, the smallholder farmers we work with, I think it's a crop made for them, made to solve their needs. This is very unique in that every month farmers make an income out of it. So you harvest on a monthly basis, and that is something that you don't get in most agricultural crops. Sometimes you harvest for 3-4 months and that is it.
Right.
For others, just a one-time harvest. But for oil palm, you harvest right from January to December, except that the yields decrease a little in the lean season, which is from June to the end of the year. And that makes oil palm unique. So a farmer who doesn't have any other job could just see oil palm as something that gets him a regular monthly income, and it helps him take care of his family. And it gives you the opportunity to plan your income as well. So that's one great thing about oil palm. And the other side of it is that you hardly throw any part of the oil palm tree away. So after processing even the palm kernels, you can sell the cake. And then when you crack the nuts too, you can sell the shells to other people who buy them for firing their furnaces and have other uses. So all part of the oil palm tree is very useful. And I believe those who make evil out of oil palm, it shouldn't be seeing the crop that way. It is a crop that is rather a blessing. And the problem is not the crop, it is the manner in which people cultivate them. I believe if you cultivate it sustainably, the benefits are very huge for companies like Serenity Farm. We just highlight how you can use oil palm to change the lives of the poor.
Yes. And are you finding that others around the world are watching what you do and they're finding that they're following suit?
I think so. Not many people are doing what we do. And we just continue talking to people just like yourself about what we do. And we know at the end of the day, a lot of people get to hear the story, and several people also show interest in what we do. Others replicate it on their projects, and we are happy to continue sharing what we do with others.
Some beautiful folks doing some great things with their lives here. Fred Provenza, Didi Pursehouse, and Safianu Moro. I'm Robin Clare at cultivatedaudio.com. Thanks for being here and for making Here Where We Want to Be.